Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 14th, 2022, and welcome to episode 258 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way?
ERCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, neurons, rats, and, I don't know, moving internationally? I don't know what it's about. We'll find out. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts. Carrington Vanston from Toronto, how are you?
I'm excellent. I can honestly say I have more neurons than rats.
That's great.
Even Quinn would admit that.
That's a good problem to have, I guess.
And Quinn, from where?
The wilderness of British Columbia.
Fantastic. Is also joining us, yes. So how are you?
I'm excellent. As alluded to in your intro, I'm very near the end, if there is really ever an end, to moving from the United States back to Canada. So very excited to be here and be recording here for the first time. And very soon I'll have all of my retro computers unpacked here. I've got a bigger office here now, so I'm going to set some stuff up. Going to have some permanent retro computing fun in here. That's going
to
be great.
Have to unpack all the extra U's.
This will be your first screen yard blue screen in Canada.
Yeah, exactly. So my first Canadian
fun.
Stream yard blue screen. Yeah,
that'll be fun.
It's going to be great. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Look forward to that in 5 or 6 minutes.
Yeah.
So we've been kind of like following this pattern of trying to talk about the year that corresponds to the episode number. We are on episode 258, and so that corresponds to 1958. And so we're I guess, going to talk about some things that happened in 1958. So there is no other coherent thread, I don't think, that ties any of these things together.
Computers.
Yeah. I guess something having to do with retro computing, perhaps. I don't know, Carrington, you had found some stuff. Do you want to start with yours?
Sure, yeah. Oh, in fact, I'll share a little screen here because I think I've got it so I can actually do that again, which would be fun for everybody. On the Cornell Chronicle, good read, I found a cool article about Frank Rosenblatt and his perceptron. And on screen at the moment, if you're listening, is a photo of Frank Rosenblatt, young Frank Rosenblatt, and his perceptron. And so the 1950s, late 1950s, seemed to be like a big banner era for trying to make computers think. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk later about Lisp, which comes about then. And the perceptron was this attempt to do machine learning. So the idea is you'd have a computer with a little sort of a video sensor, and you would show it things, and you would have the computer say, is this a cat or dog? It was what they call a two-layer perception. So it couldn't determine like a whole bunch of things. It would be like cat or not cat, dog or not, circle or not circle, left or not left. And so that was what he was attempting to do. Can you get a computer to look at a thing, kind of figure it out, but you don't program it. You do exactly what you do nowadays. I guess it was the first CAPTCHA. You would show it a picture, and it would say, I think it's a cat. And you'd say, no, it's not. And if you just iterate a million times, the computer should be able to now recognize the photo of a cat. That was the idea, which does not at all sound like a weird idea now. It's like, okay, machine learning. Yeah, we do that. 1958, it was scoffed at and laughed and didn't really succeed. Eventually, the funding was shut down. They never really got it working because there was this argument that you couldn't do that with a computer. It was nonsense. The world is too complicated. What would be the sense of a computer that could say cat or not cat or this or not that? Nobody was thinking, well, instead of two layers, what if it was just able to see the world or like millions of layers or whatever? So it didn't really go anywhere, but is now recognized as the origins of like you know, a thing we do. So it's kind of cool. So there's a neat article about it. What I also learned in this article was before this, what Mr. Rosenblatt was doing was taking bits of the brains of rats. They would run a rat through a maze. The rats would learn all about the maze. He would kill the rat, take parts of the brain they thought were for maze learning, and inject them in the brains of other rats, and then see, do they now know how to do the maze? So it was also a pretty crazy time.
Yeah.
And then after taking out his ire on enough rats, he said, well, maybe we can do it with a computer instead. Interesting article. Let me tell you, I highly recommend reading this article. It's my favorite thing from 1958.
There is something. What is the name of the worm that learns? it's got like a very, very simple sort of like neural setup that you can actually like fully map because it's that simple.
Okay.
But in fact, you this maybe had no chance of working with a rat. But I think if you take one of those worms and train it to turn left, and then feed it to another worm. The other worm can turn left as well.
Okay, Mr. Rosenblatt, tell me more of your ideas.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad that this is not my area.
But anyway, that was one of the cool things going on when it comes to AI and machine learning, etc. 1950s, late 1950s in particular, seems to be big on this. And I guess we'll talk later about how it's also the year that Lisp was founded. Lisp, of course, stands for Let's Invent Silly Programming Languages.
Yes.
There's one that's Let's Invent Silly Parentheses or something. There's another variation on that with parentheses. On the perceptron, though, what's also cool about this is that this is still a thing. So I actually didn't realize it dated back this far to this guy. So most of my career was spent doing AI. And if you take AI in school or you do a lot of it in industry, you learn about neural networks. And one of the most basic and first neural networks you learn is the perceptron. So we still call it that, in fact, and it's still an algorithm that's used. It doesn't involve the death of any rats, but it is still...
It doesn't have to.
Well, yeah, I guess that's extracurricular, but it still has that same structure, and it's still a foundation of all of machine learning today. So it's really cool that it goes back this far to 1958. It's one thing you learn a lot in computer science is that everything is way older than you think it is. Like, most of the concepts date back to like some mathematician from like 500 years ago or something. It's like, oh yeah, they had this stuff figured out. They just didn't have technology for it yet.
They hated rats even back then.
All right, let's see. So I guess one of the things that I found was, or was looking into a little bit, was Lisp. Though I actually, you know, I didn't myself work that much with Lisp. I worked with it a little bit. So maybe you know, the rest of you will actually have more experience with this. You know, I think in the...
We'll all make the same food.p joke.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you look at the YouTube stream description, it just says podcast P? ? So
that's what all of us take away from doing Lisp is we all learn that joke.
Right. But so anyway, I guess what the event was that it was defined. It was sort of specified in 1958, and it has, you know, found its way into Emacs and, you know, all sorts of other things. I think it's a ancestor of Logo as well.
It's an ancestor of ZIL, Z-I-L, the uh-huh. Zork language. So that's kind of where I know it as.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it gets exciting for me, is they made Zork out of it.
Yeah. It does sort of seem like you must have been able to do this without the pile of 75 parentheses at the end. But because that is the one thing that just makes it really, really hard to work with. But it is, you know, it's quite cool in the way that, in how flexible it is. When I was in graduate school, I did a little bit of Lisp programming, and I have attempted to modify some Emacs macros occasionally because Emacs uses this as a scripting language. But that was mostly about it.
Isn't it true also that Emacs is actually also written in Lisp, if I'm not mistaken?
I did not know that.
I kind of thought it was, and then I couldn't find anything backing that up.
Okay. Yeah, I guess don't quote me on this, but yeah. it has at least always had the reputation of being one of those IDEs that is written in a version of itself.
Mm-hmm.
The other big one is Maya. Maya is a scripting engine that was used to build a 3D rendering package that uses itself as a scripting engine. It's all very GNU-y and, you know, recursive, but yeah, mm-hmm. that's...
That's interesting. I knew like Emacs, there was Emacs Lisp, like you could do Lisp in Emacs, but I didn't know Emacs was made of Lisp.
Yeah,
we're again, all made of Lisp.
Don't quote us on that, but yeah, it's, they do at least use it as like the macro scripting language for modifying the UI and creating hotkeys and stuff. But yeah, I think the editor itself is also written in Lisp.
Cool.
There's another thing that I only know a little bit about is that there were, at least at some point, Lisp machines. There were sort of machines that were specifically designed to run Lisp. Symbolics was one of the companies that was kind of the forefront of that, I think.
Yeah, there was some work done on hardware-accelerated Lisp execution as well. Like people had visions of, you know, writing AI, like computers that treated AI as a first-class citizen, basically, rather than trying to run it on, machine language. Let's build a computer that runs Lisp more natively and thus will be more well-suited to AI. I don't think it ever really went anywhere, but it was an interesting idea.
I know I've looked a little bit at, like I see on eBay these coprocessor cards you can put into Mac 2s, because that was actually one of the platforms that, you know, the Symbolics, I forget what it was called. It'll come to me at some point, but Symbolics actually made cards that you would stick in a Mac 2. So the Mac 2 sort of served as the IO but the brain was on the card. And I have in fact actually managed to set up OpenGenera. Genera, I don't know how you would want to pronounce that, but which is a, you know, sort of Lisp OS. So I've got what I've got up here on the screen is a instructions on how you set it up in Linux, how you can kind of like bring up something like an X Windows environment that it's all sort of defined in Lisp functions. And so like the way you load it up is essentially you load the frame of it, and then the entire operating system is defined on a par with everything else. You know, it's like, I don't know what, like fourth or something, you know, it's like there's only a couple of primitives and then everything's built from that. Anyway, I got it working long enough to realize that I didn't really know how to make it do anything. But it was sort of interesting. So symbolics.com, by the way, I think may well have been the very first internet address, like .com address.
Oh, cool.
So,
wow.
Not super related to 1958 or Lisp, really, but anyway, it's an interesting fact, and I think somebody rich has bought it by now.
It's interesting that idea of hardware dedicated to running specific languages kind of comes and goes every 20 years or so. People decide to try it again. So that was one of SGI's founding principles as well, was hardware that ran OpenGL natively, and not in the way that we do today, where there's a graphical API that you use to build, you know, vertex lists and polygons, data structures and stuff. No, it actually executed OpenGL, the imperative version of it, as natively as one can anyway. It was hardware dedicated to that exact form of rendering. And it went as far as the Nintendo 64, and then everyone decided maybe that wasn't such a good idea after all, because the APIs are changing faster than you can change the hardware. So it was itself being held back by that idea eventually, which is probably what happens to all of these things. You know, the language moves on and the hardware can't keep up.
So while we've been talking, I've been reading, I've gone down a tangent because of Blake in the chat, who talked about a thing called OpenWorm. Mm-hmm. I then looked at and been reading all about roundworms, the C. elegans worm, which you were talking about before,
yes.
And the little 20-day live worms that are used for such things. And there's a thing called OpenWorm that is basically, this thing is crazy. So they're modeling that worm, trying to like make a computer version. Like here's a virtual version of that worm. And they talk about the limitation of the model, and great phrase, all models are wrong, some models are useful. I'm like, I am going to use that so much. Yeah. And you can get involved in it. It's an open source thing to create a digital version of this worm. And it's a fascinating, so I've got a link in the show notes. It is fascinating. And the worms themselves are fascinating. Like they use them to like research tons of things in biology and human diseases and stuff. I didn't know really anything about these worms.
Well, is it a phyla or a species? The group of roundworm is like, it's one of the oldest multicellular species on the planet. Like it was one of the very first things to evolve, if I'm not mistaken. So it, that makes it very useful because it has very primitive structures throughout. So it's a really good kind of first principles form of biology to mess with.
This is fascinating. I have no biology background at all, so all of this is fascinating to me.
I
dig it.
I very much like the fact that open worm exists. Actually, probably the population of worms also likes the fact that this exists.
Right. Yes, they're very grateful for
it. Right. Yeah. We only live for 20 days, man. Can you just leave us alone, please, for 3 weeks? Just go do your digital version. Anyway, fascinating. Fascinating little detour I just took. Open worm is cool. Everyone should get involved. I don't have time.
Excellent. Okay, so there were a couple of other 1958 things. One of them was in our show notes ahead of time, I promise, but End of the Line Joel also pointed it out, that Tennis for Two was released in 1958.
Yes, it is. Got in the show notes as sort of, kind of, not really, maybe the first video game, comma, not.
Right. And wait, let's wait for the nerds to finish arguing. And
the nerds do not finish arguing.
And resume. Okay, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of argument about that. And is it Ralph Baer, is that his name? I think is one of the most stalwart of arguers in that. He spent a long time working to get credit for Tennis for Two, if I'm not mistaken. Because for a long time, he wasn't recognized as being what is, I think, quite fairly the first video game, for sure.
Yeah, I don't actually know too much about it, but it sounds like, you know, Pong V1. Pong Alpha
kind of,
1.
Yeah, it's like tennis, even more than Pong, because it's played on an oscilloscope.
Yeah.
Cool.
And it's essentially completely analog. What's interesting about it, I mean, he invented a lot of ideas with that. You know, he invented interactivity, he invented the idea of a game controller, and it's essentially all analog, so it's just kind of, it's hard to describe analog computing to people, mm-hmm. but like there isn't really... there isn't a sequence of instructions being executed. It's just sort of a whole bunch of math that's always happening, and you're influencing the math. And if you do that just right, you can kind of create this effect of a sequence of time with a ball bouncing back and forth. But it's certainly pushing, I think, ideas of analog computing about as far as you can. Let's just say that.
Yeah. But we're watching the video of this on the stream, and that's amazing. I mean, that's way better than Pong.
Yeah.
I guess it's probably somewhat expensive to get one of those in your living room, but...
the thing to remember is that it's somewhat faker than it appears, because you're moving the paddle, you're moving the ball, kind of like how Mario steers his falls, because again, it's not really sampling your input or simulating physics in any way, it's just... the dot is oscillating and you're moving it with the paddle. And then there's a sort of a form of collision detection with the net. So again, analog computing is very difficult to explain because it's not really sequential. It's all simultaneous.
I was trying to look up, I know that there was, maybe it was a hockey game or something. There was a mechanical game, that we have seen before where, you know, there's like a little LED on a arm or something that's underneath a sort of a smoked plastic screen, so you can't actually see what's happening, but it's like you're playing a video game, except it's all actually mechanical.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's an excellent way to explain how this works. So I think we did talk about that on a recent episode. Someone had found one of those on, I think it was on Hackaday. They'd found one of those old mechanical Pong machines and restored it. It was actually like, it was like a cheap plastic thing. It's amazing that there was a moment in time where it was cheaper to make a mechanical, this complicated mechanical contraption to play Pong than it was to just use chips. Mm-hmm. But there was a moment where that was true. And so the cheap, crappy home version of Pong was mechanical. And that's actually a perfect analogy for what Tennis for Two is doing, because, you know, you've got an arm that's just swinging the ball back and forth, and then you've got two other arms that can influence the positions of the paddles. And then, you know, that's mechanical systems and analog systems are very much analogous to each other in how they work.
Hmm. It was called Blip. I remember ads on television for this thing.
This is actually different than the one I was referring to. I wonder if I can find that one.
So there is, it does have,
that's awesome.
It does have a battery, but it does, but it, there's also a, you know, but it is definitely mechanical. So, oh, maybe it doesn't have a battery. No, you wind it up. It's got a spring energy. Cool. What else was there? I think there was something else, as well.
From 1958?
Yeah.
Well, you had logo in there in the show notes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I guess that was part of, ARPA, that was part of the list. Of stuff. I think I put logo in there because of its Lisp heritage.
Okay. Well, ARPA gets founded in 1958, and so that gives us ARPANET, which gives us internet. Way at the end of the show, I'll talk about it, but I read a couple of books recently, both of which I really liked, and one was called Where Wizards Stay Up Late, which is the kind of the history of the founding of ARPA and ARPANET and the development of the early internet. And it was really, really, really good. Highly recommend it. I seriously enjoyed it. So, Where Wizards Stay Up Late. Good book. No idea if it was accurate, but I really enjoyed it. That's good enough for me. And this show.
And then also listed here is the development of the 101 modem.
Which is the first modem, really, for computers. And so Bell Labs did that. And it
intro to modems.
Was for a particular computer, though. Which computer was it for? Not ENIAC. Something early like that. It was specific
Sage.
For those. Sage, okay, Sage. So, oh, that's that big one that took up like a whole floor. Yeah, okay, so Sage. So no doubt the modem was also the size of a car or something. Mm. It may have just been a car driving back and forth with documents. That counts. That counts as a modem.
First released by AT&T in 1958 for the Sage system of large computers used by NORAD. So
see,
also it has a nice War Games tie-in.
I think 1958 is also NASA gets founded, but I didn't look that up. In my mind, part of my brain, my rat brain that got injected, some earlier rat knew for some reason that 1958 is also NASA.
So, cool.
That's in my personal perceptron.
Probably it would have been NACA at the time.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Before it was NASA. Yeah.
Rats can't really tell the difference between C's and S's. So. Right.
Yeah. So the Bell 101, 150 BPI.
That's tons.
Yeah. Actually,
that's surprisingly high.
Exactly.
That's pretty darn good. Yeah.
That's like half of 300. Although I don't know, what is an I? 150 BPI. I think of 300 as being BPS.
Oh. Yeah. Good question. Bits per interval?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know what the I would be. Because, it might be an hour, in which case, not so good.
Yeah.
Right.
So that numbering, I wonder what that numbering system is. So, like, you might recall, the Apple II had a modem called the Apple Cat II.
Wait, let me get my bingo card.
Okay. Yeah, but anyway.
Good, all right.
So,
just need Carrington's girlfriend to complete the row.
So, I do know, though, that the designation for 1200 full duplex was 212, and for 1200 half duplex was 202. So there was some system there with those numbers. 101 somehow is translatable. But so maybe it was half duplex, 150 baud. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll say that until someone writes an angry letter telling us otherwise.
Okay.
I remember the first time I had a half duplex connection, like early on when I was playing with modems, I connected to like a friend's computer. And how I think about half duplex is when I would type, and I'd be like, the other person, because we're also talking, we're just in other rooms, and would shout, I can see what you're typing. I'm like, I can't see what I'm typing. I'm only sending, I'm not viewing. Is this what half duplex means? I don't understand modems. So
and the answer is no. That's just echo.
But my first thing that we decided, that must be half duplex. Like that person sees it, but you don't. Yeah. So you only get, I don't know, what half a plex is. So I don't know. We were kids. It was just very exciting to be talking like three rooms away on a computer. It was fascinating. So much better than walking over there and speaking in person.
That's right.
That remains true to this day.
That's right. You just text the person you're sitting next to.
Right. Yep.
Cool. Anyway, yeah. So 1958 was a pretty good year, I guess. Okay, so I guess we can move on to what? I guess there's a bit of feedback. So Scott on Facebook mentioned that So he had come up, actually, I think this one of the most recent times you were on, Quinn, we were talking about removing stickers and labels, and Scott pointed out a YouTube video by Deviant Oleum, I think, which is basically about opening wristbands, for hospitals and concerts and that kind of thing, like ways that you can get these apart without destroying them. And also, he was also, I think, trying to get the little like holographic "this has not been tampered with" stickers off, so there's a video that we could probably link to, which
all sounds very legit.
Yeah, but it
just randomly found this thing about how to delaminate driver's licenses. I don't know. It's something to do with stickers.
But it seemed like some of the techniques might be sort of similar. So the various kinds of chemicals are used to get the things on and off.
An envelope full of syringes. I'm just going to go on record and say this is not getting less sketchy.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, though. But, yeah, it does seem like the goal is to be able to put your "this has not been tampered with" on the thing you tampered with. Anyway, but it could potentially have useful information if you're trying to get stickers safely off of an ET3400 or whatever it is we were trying to do.
Yeah, actually, syringes full of something like alcohol or whatever are probably, yeah, like a really good way to get stickers off of old computers for sure. I think that's a really helpful technique, even though this channel definitely looks like maybe a counterfeiting channel.
Yeah, but a real one. Yeah, there's some of the stuff is not super relevant. Like, you know, don't use this because it will cause it to bleed. That might be relevant. Don't use heat because it'll cause it to melt to your. Yeah, actually, there's some point earlier on in this where he was trying a heat gun with like a bunch of like heat shielding on his arm, and didn't seem like actually a very wise move, but. So, thanks, Scott, for that dive into a world I didn't really know existed, but suspected. And then, let's see, the other bit of feedback I will mention is Tony wrote about the Leo, the story of the world's first business computer, something that was...
I love things that are supposedly the world's first. Yeah. Bring it. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
It's the best.
This is... it's published by the Center for Computing History, and it... one of the things that was relevant about this is that Tony wrote to us to say, this is not a computer that he'd ever heard of. So apparently it's the Lyons Electronic Office, and it's the first, it was sort of like, I think the idea is it's the first computer set up for a business application. Like it's, you know, sort of like a...
so that's what you got to do. You got to start with the word first, and they get narrower and narrower and narrower.
Then the business adjectives come. Yeah. First commercially successful...
Yeah, first that computer used for commercial business applications is what Wikipedia claims.
Right.
Yeah,
that was named after a constellation.
Yeah, right. But it's interesting. I hadn't heard of it. You know, it was.
I have not heard of it either.
You know,
so this is the first time I've heard.
Ah, yes. You should read our our feedback account then.
I'm reading about worms.
Just seemed like it was you know sort of a CEO who was all in on new tech and wanted to just try everything out. And so,
I mean, I guess it's a reasonable claim if this was in fact used by an actual business in 1951, which is extremely early for anyone besides like, you know, Navy targeting computers and experimental science stuff. Like for someone to actually be using it in an industrial setting is pretty remarkable for 1951.
And it's also pretty cool that the you know Center for Computing History actually went and interviewed these people while they are still interviewable, because we're getting close to the end of that time.
Although for something like this, you always got to wonder, like, okay, did they actually use it in the sense that it made their business better and made it more efficient and did things in a way that was better than how they might have otherwise done them, as opposed to like when everyone got their Apple II and we all put our recipes into it and then realized it's actually worse than just using a recipe box. And but we did it for a little while anyway because we had this expensive toy and we wanted to justify its existence. So
right.
I sort of feel like this might be that, but just on a CEO scale.
Right. Yeah, when I was in sort of like late junior high, very early high school, I worked at a hotel that had a... The person who, the owner of it, had this kind of a attitude as well. It was sort of like, read all the current computer magazines, got all the new stuff when it was brand new. So that's why I had the Epson QX10, because it was well regarded. He bought the first ones. We had a whole bunch of these Bernoulli drives because they were supposed to be, you know, the next new thing or whatever. So it was kind of fun working for such a guy.
Yeah, we've all been there. I tortured myself for a semester of university with the first Newton, just totally convincing myself that this was better than taking notes on paper, and it was absolutely worse in every way than taking notes on paper. But boy, I tried.
I've done that sort of thing. I still do that sort of thing.
Yeah, I almost failed that class. The drawing recognizer wouldn't keep up with the drawings in this hardware class. I was trying to sketch the schematics and stuff, and it wouldn't keep up, and it was bad. Yeah. I had all these half-complete diagrams that I was trying to study from, and it was terrible. Thanks a lot, Newton.
I've been watching this It's actually, I think it's on the Apple TV network. I lose track, but it's called For All Mankind. It's a, you know, yep, it's like Space Show or whatever.
Plus, yeah.
And you know, it's right. Alternate universe sort of launches off from the point of the Russians getting to the moon first, and then whatever followed from that. But one of the things that showed up in the most recent series was that the Newton survived. The Newton was like the video phone that they were using in the 90s. It was pretty great.
That's how you know it's fiction.
That's right. Maybe I'll leave it there, and we can move on to the items of interest.
Blake is going to be really mad that we talked about Newtons without him, by the way.
Yep.
Oh, is he?
That's what you get.
Yeah. We talk about Newtons all the time. We'll have other chances to talk about Newtons.
Right. I'm just going to say a bunch of wrong stuff about Amigas now. Just
okay.
To complete the circle.
Oh, right. Let's see. Lost documents is next.
That's me. Yes. So the Lost Tron documents, computers, arcade games, whatever. I like them both. I'm going to talk about it on this show. This is a really, really interesting blog article, but pretty in-depth about the origin of the Tron arcade game. I love the Tron movie. I love the arcade games, whatever. This is great. So if you like this thing, this is a deep dive into the origin of it. And a lot of cool pictures. What I learned from this is there originally were six little mini games, not four. There's also Rings, which became Discs of Tron, became its own thing, and it's something called Paranoia, where you're supposed to build a bridge of spiders. But it's a really fascinating deep dive with you can download the game proposal. You can download specs and letters that went back and forth kind of discussing the development and what worked and what didn't work, and just like, it's amazing, like just goes through the entire, like just real deep behind the scenes stuff in the creation of this arcade game, and one that I have always super loved. So if you like it as much as I do, it's highly recommended. I love this game. So, and it's computer related, it's a computer movie, and it's got some computer stuff, so that counts, totally counts.
That's cool.
It's a great game. And if anyone has never, if you ever find the environmental Discs of Tron cabinet, or
one of my all-time favorite games, it's specifically so that. In Toronto, there was the arcade I used to go to when it was new, had an environmental Discs of Tron, and it just take all my money, take everything. I just spent all my time playing that thing. It's one of the all-time great arcade experiences. Love that one.
It's funny. I have not that experience at all. I have the experience of repeatedly attempting this and, you know, being dead within like 30 seconds and saying, this is stupid, I'm going to play Ms. Pac-Man.
That was with Discs of Tron or the regular Tron game?
I think it was actually probably Discs of Tron. It was I just couldn't control the thing. I was, you know, trying to send these Frisbees around and it wasn't working.
That's Discs of Tron then. Probably,
That's the one where you're leaping back and forth. So joystick and a spinner.
Yeah.
Great control set. Love it. Environmental controls. The sound. Oh, it's so amazing. Even as minimalist, I'd have one of those behind me right now if I could. But I don't.
They're rare. The environmental Discs of Tron cabinets are super rare. I've only ever seen one. There was pre-COVID, there was an arcade show way out in the California desert, this tiny little town that I forget. There was a guy who happened to live out there, and he had like 1,000 arcade machines. So he decided to create a museum and open it a couple years or so. And he has one that's just mint condition, and that's the only place
he lives in the desert with 1,000 arcade machines. I want to hang out with this guy. I want to take this fellow to lunch and just be near him. Sounds like a really interesting person.
Yeah, it was awesome. The first time they ran it's kind of like a show and also just sort of like an open house. And the first time he did it, Billy Mitchell showed up. So I have a picture with Billy Mitchell from that.
And he claimed that all of these games were his. And he had not only got the high score, but invented most of them. And nobody can prove him otherwise.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah,
he's,
okay.
He's quite a character.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm now scrolling through these, you know, the screenshots of the regular Tron game, and I am remembering this now, and I was better at the regular one than I was at the Discs one.
I'm not honestly great at either of them, but I think I'm better at Discs of Tron, to be honest.
Well, the regular one is fine because it's a bunch of mini games. You can kind of pick the mini game that you like and play it and then just
but
die.
But you gotta finish them to get to the to the next level, right?
Die, so. And you put in another quarter and you play the mini game that you like again. That's how I played regular Tron. There's only like two of them that I'm any good at, so the other four I just die and put in another quarter.
Excellent. Okay, let's see. My thing should be actually fairly short. It is a couple of people wrote in to mention this. Tony and Bob both wrote in to tell us that CPM's open source status has been clarified. It, after 21 years, it is now. And I think that if I understood this correctly, the clarification was essentially something in the language of the original statement that it was available. It also mentioned that you had to get it from, I forget where it was, like there's a particular, like the unofficial CPM website or something was given permission, but it wasn't clear that anyone else had it. So that is now rectified. So in case you were feeling guilty up until now, you can calm yourself and use CPM 2.2.
Yeah, I think the point of the clarification was that there's no restriction. Like it was always the case, but they're clarifying that yes, the intention was there's no restriction on like how and where it can be distributed. Mm-hmm. Hackaday was saying how the free OS is now even freer. it's even extra double free.
Yeah.
Earl should be here. He likes CPM.
Yeah. And CPM is fine, but yeah.
Is it?
I don't know. I guess I find it hard to bring myself to care that much. Like I guess what I'm about the licensing.
Wow, real talk here to the RCR.
Yeah, real talk here from Paul about CPM.
Wow.
So okay, let me clarify.
Send your hate mail too.
I think CPM is great, but
Earl has joined the chat.
I don't know that I would really refrain from using it prior to having read this email if I had gotten it off a different website, you know?
You mean care about this clarification? I think I care about CPM in general. Oh, I see.
And, you know, it's great that people do, and probably it is right that people do, but I can't quite bring myself there. But anyway, so I guess the official on cpm.z80.de, there is the official email that makes this happen. So it buried in amongst a bunch of text in a red highlighted part is the thing.
I think this is just sort of like a tiny window into the world of like the hardcore open source movement where people work really hard to get this one email that makes it official that we can definitely use this thing or this source code in this other thing. And the rest of us just
kind of...
Which is
good because it protects us from monsters who will read that same thing and go, aha, because of this, now that I bought that company, all of you owe me money. So.
Yeah, yeah. We're all glad they exist. And meanwhile, the rest of us are...
Yeah, Paul.
All right.
Some of us care.
But no, I'm kind of with Paul. I mean, retro computing hobbyists are more of the beg for forgiveness than ask permission school of old software. But yeah, I'm glad that there are people like us out there doing this.
Yeah. Anyway, that was it. That was, so CPM is now available to all.
And to all a good night.
Yeah. Okay, Quinn, you have the next thing.
I do. So I'm going to share this for the benefit of our streaming viewers that are going to get an awesome little thing here. So this is playing YouTube video on a pet. And we've seen this is a popular thing that people are doing with retro computers lately is finding ways to stream video on them. And so this is kind of in that school of stunt, but it's got some really cool twists because, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, the pet does not have pixel addressable graphics, so how on earth could you possibly display video on it, not to mention the lack of horsepower to process codecs and so on. So the way this is being done is he's created a box he's calling the Blix term, and what's incredibly clever about it, so it does all of the internet stuff. There's a Raspberry Pi in there, and it does all the internet stuff, but I'll pause this video here because you can see what it's doing. It's the Blix term is downloading the video from, or streaming the video from YouTube, and each frame, it's breaking the video up into like 5x8 pixel chunks or whatever, and then figuring out which character in the pet character set most closely matches that pattern of pixels.
Amazing.
And then placing that character into a dual port shared SRAM that's attached to the Raspberry Pi, which is then plugged into the user port on the pet. And then there's code running on the pet to pull those characters out of that shared dual port RAM and put them on into video RAM. So the pet is just copying bytes as quick as it can, essentially. And then the Blix term is processing the video into characters. And the effect is really quite remarkable. Like, obviously it doesn't look amazing, but it does, like, you can recognize it. You can see that this is a car drifting around in the snow.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing how well it does actually work. So the video that we'll link to is a very elaborate description of how every single piece in this chain works. But the video, if you just want to see what it looks like, it's in the within the first minutes. You can kind of skim through and find that. So really, really clever, really cool effect. I mean, I love seeing something like this that's as effective as this is within what should be an impossible set of limitations from the hardware. So really cool.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So, very cool. I think I found that on Hackaday, and I love stunts like this. And I mean, this is definitely one of those things where it's debatable if how much of this is really running on the machine. You know, I mean, obviously the Raspberry Pi is doing 99.99% of the heavy lifting. We've looked at other hacks, for example, the recent ones that we did on the Apple II, where people were streaming video, and recently podcasts as well, that where the audio or the video is pre-compiled essentially, and so the machine is running real code that's pushing the pixels. It's just being fed a series of instructions that have been pre-processed by something else. So this is kind of in that vein, probably a little less so, because literally all the PET is doing is copying bytes. It's still neat to see it happening, I think.
Yeah, and it is super effective.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, the interaction is entirely on the PET. So there's a little UI at the start where you type in the URL of a YouTube video, and the PET talks to the Blix term to go and get that video. So that, I think that's another twist on this that I like, is that you can literally watch any YouTube video live. There's no, you know, downloading it and processing it and pre-compiling it or anything like that. Like, it really is streaming the video live from YouTube. It's just sort of doing this this on-the-fly transcoding of the frames into PET characters, PETSCII characters, which is super neat.
All right. Carrington, did you have another one? I see you.
Nope.
Okay.
I was going to talk about CPM, but you stole it.
Oh, seriously?
Yes. That was my second one.
Does that mean you can bring yourself to care about CPM?
Yes. I care very deeply.
Okay.
I was injected with a worm that used to love CPM.
Right.
Full
that
circle.
Worm's name was Earl.
I think I'll mention this one other thing, because it actually sort of blends into something else that is worth talking about too. This is, I think this, so Blake actually brought this to our attention. It is system.css. And what it is basically a CSS set that gives you essentially like System 6 era Mac, sort of like web elements.
Right. This was in the context that we're redoing the RCR site, right? That's why you brought this up. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to try to move hosts, which means one great thing that means, yes, well, Carrington is very pleased not to have to deal with Squarespace anymore. Can we badmouth Squarespace now?
Yes.
this episode not brought to you by. one of the things is that it limited our back feed to 30 episodes, and there's absolutely no way around that. Like, you cannot make that be anymore. And so we are going to move to something else, which means, by the way, it's conceivable that suddenly many of you out there will have like 220 new episodes in the feed. I hope that is not the case.
Them all.
But
it's really hard to move a podcast without that happening. Some version of that problem happens to every single podcast.
Well, the problem is, and I think we're going to be doing the same thing. Like, what I do with MonsterFeed stuff is you separate. The website has nothing to do with the feed. The feed should be wherever, and that's its own thing. Moving the feed is difficult, but that's it. So stick your feed on Libsyn or whatever and just say, that's there. And then here's the website nobody goes to.
Yeah, we will think about that. Though, actually, I have revealed, I think
he said dismissed
somewhere, that CyberEars, famous from the first couple, seconds of this podcast, does have its own feed that does go all the way back, so it
could have just been using that. They've been an excellent host to us.
Yeah, except that
rock solid hosting
with unlimited
bandwidth. I said that once. I've heard it 10,000 times.
Anyway, but system.css is pretty cool. It's entirely CSS, so it's not JavaScript. You can just use it to make your site look like, you know, an old black and white Mac. And
I do want our site to look like that. That's cool.
Made in good fun and largely inspired by 98.css, which is a similar sort of thing, but can make your website look like Windows 98.
Cool.
So anyway, I thought that was neat and a way to introduce the fact that you might have many, many new episodes in your feed soon.
New.
As long as it's still my audio and my terms.
That's right. Okay. Let's see. What is next? I guess it must be now time for a word from our sponsor.
Blip is the digital game that you can take with you anywhere. With the batteries you supply, the light-emitting diode zips across the screen. You try to press the right button to send it back. An automatic readout keeps score. Two people or only one can play. When you play with Blip, you get carried away. So does Blip. Blip, the digital game. From Tomy.
Not every great movie or great arcade game makes a great home video game. That's why when Mattel Electronics turned Tron into Tron Home Video Games, we made sure the excitement of Tron gameplay found its way into your home. You'll know it the moment you square off against a recognizer, if you last that long. Four great Tron games, two for Intellivision, two for Atari 2600. From Mattel Electronics, games as good as we say they are, maybe better.
And we're back. Okay, so the host retro computing gift idea this time was pointed out to us by Tony over email, and it is the Myst vinyl soundtrack, which I thought was kind of a cool idea. So it is a 2 LP set, and it has, you know, music from Myst, basically. You know, I guess it's the ambient soundtrack, I guess, from Myst. To be honest, I have no real reason to believe that this is official, except for the fact that it says official Myst product on it. It's on fangamer.com, which doesn't inspire a lot of trust, but
maybe.
Who knows? Know. They have a lot of they have many collections, so it's Myst, yeah. But also like
this
many
games.
Seems
legit to me.
Okay,
it might be licensed, like yeah. Officially yeah. Licensed or whatever. Because like I think the original two authors still own all the rights to Myst, so right. Someone might have just written them up and said, "Hey, can we make some stuff for your Myst?" And then we're like, "Sure."
I'd like to point out that putting one of the vinyls is red rather than cyan. That seems a Myst opportunity.
Yeah.
Did you say a Myst opportunity?
Oh, good grief.
I'll feed myself out.
No, it's awesome.
Okay. Yeah, I think the red and blue actually is supposed to relate to the books, you know, but sure. Okay. Cyan, that would have been smart. Maybe it should have been a 3 set. Anyway, it actually looks really nice. And if you are...
Problem is, once you get it, it takes like 6 or 7 days to open it up. You really have to work
right,
at it.
Right. They've got this weird combination lock, and it just makes little weird clicking noises.
You have to go to a lighthouse and crank a bunch of things.
Yeah.
Look out the window and go, I think I moved that river. What has happened?
So it's an interesting little novelty. It's not super expensive. It's $45. It does say by Robin Miller. So, I mean, like they're at least crediting actual Myst people. So.
Well, maybe it's 100% just them then. Or
yeah.
Him.
Yeah.
I wonder if you play that while you're playing the game, at what point do things like line up? I play really yeah. quickly. I've only got 45 minutes to finish this game.
Right. Yeah, I don't. But I was going to say that the soundtrack is one of the things that really, really made that game. I mean, that it really made it very immersive. I don't know how they designed it exactly, but they designed it really well. You know, it didn't get tiring. It didn't get super tiring. It maybe got a little tiring, but
for me, it was my memory of the soundtrack is mostly the ambient noises. You'd be at a place and you'd hear the creaking or you'd hear the water or whatever, right? And it was very immersive that way. Mm-hmm. I loved Myst at the time. I loved it.
But there is a song that sort of plays through it. I think if you think about it for a second, you can hear it, you know, sort of like...
Sing it for us, Paul.
I decline.
Do it, Paul.
I wonder if there's a... You know, there should be a... like sample audio in here that would have been like if a track list, but It does not look like there are samples that you can hear. But that's mechanical age
for us.
Achenar's theme, Achenar's theme. See, I don't remember Myst well enough. I'm pretty sure that I made it through, but I don't remember it well enough to know what everybody's how to pronounce everyone's name. So, did you guys play the next ones, like Riven and?
I only a little bit. The only one of them that I've played through all the way is the original Myst, mm-hmm. with its teeny tiny little videos.
Yeah.
I only honestly played like 10 minutes of the original Myst, and it just wasn't my thing at the time, but I certainly respect it, and I understand why people like it. Hmm. But I should go back and try it again. I think I might enjoy it more now than I did at the time.
Problem now is there's so many versions, it's hard to know which one to play. Hmm. There's the real Myst, and there's the 3D one, and like, well, which is the good one?
Yeah.
It's very hard to know.
Yeah.
I will say that the records themselves in that item are beautiful. Like, they're mm-hmm. translucent red and blue with some kind of like screen printing on them. Like, mm-hmm. it's amazing what they can do with records nowadays.
They did it back then. I used to have printed albums and things.
Remember,
Paradise Theater by Styx had a thing where you hold it on an angle and it was all this weird laser cut thing, so you'd see an image of the Paradise Theater but only like reflected. It was super cool. And then also like picture discs, I had a bunch of albums or like big photographs on them.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that was a thing. You didn't see that very often. I guess it's
here
like
in Toronto, it was a thing. Alberta wasn't, you know, hip to it yet.
No, I mean, yeah, it was just cows.
Yeah,
tractors. Not so much.
Yeah, I kind of wonder. I am suspicious of a picture disc. You know, if what you want is audio fidelity, it may well be that a picture disc is not the way to achieve audio fidelity. But
if you want an album, why would you vinyl if you want audio fidelity?
Yeah.
I love my record player, but don't listen to records because it sounds better. I don't care, record people. Come at me. Fight me, bro. It doesn't sound better.
No, it doesn't. That warmth that people talk about is called distortion. We have a word
crackle
for that.
And pops. I just like to sit on my old couch, hold my old albums, listening to my old music because I'm old. Like, that's the real reason.
Nothing wrong with that, but don't claim it's better.
Yep. Old man yells at record.
Okay. I think
who likes old stuff? Please.
Yeah.
He said on the RCR. Old is necessarily worse.
I think we did, you know, I was kind of going through the website, you know, as I was moving stuff around to the new host, and that definitely was that topic came up several times, like, you know,
our secret belief.
Yeah, that's right. Are old things better? You know, are new things worse?
Are new topics better? No, let's just go back to this old topic.
Right.
I use my Apple II because of the warmth.
That's right. Yeah, though there might be a
literally
literal,
the warmth.
Yeah. I do occasionally forget to like turn off the monitor on my Apple III, and that's, you know, that's how I notice. It's like, it's kind of warm in here now.
Yeah, CRTs are no joke.
Yeah. Unlike 911, right? Okay. We can, after buying the vinyls, we can, there are people who get very irate about calling these things vinyls. They're made of vinyl. They're long playing records. They are not vinyls. But
well, whatever I put on my gramophone.
That's right. But anyway, okay. So we can, once we're done buying whatever those are, we can turn our attention to eBay, and Carrington has the first auction to look at there.
I have a very cool auction. It's made the rounds on.
And it's not actually at eBay.
It's not at eBay. It's RR Auction. The place for pirates.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cool. There is a pretty significant auction going on right now. You can get Steve Jobs' original prototype the Apple One. Currently bid up to $407,000 with just 19 bids. A couple days left to go in this auction. So if you got a cool $500,000, you can buy yourself an Apple One. But it's just, and you know how, like, I have frequently said with these Apple Ones come up on eBay and what have you, you can spend $500,000 on a computer that's essentially useless. But get rid of the word essentially. How about actually useless? here's a non-working one. Here's a prototype. Hmm. But, you know, valuable because it's a prototype. But still kind of cool. So it's the Steve Jobs's, or Wozniak, I would have said. It's his hand, and created a little prototype. That's cool. There's Next stuff. Mm-hmm. There's Apple IIe with a French external keyboard. That's also a prototype. Steve Wozniak, we've talked about this before, the CL9, the universal remote control. There's one of those. But there's some things I've never seen before. How about this? The Apple Quad Apple. So the Apple Cross. Apparently a medal that Apple handed out to people. What the heck is this? Have you guys seen this before? What's the Apple Cross medal?
Never seen
nope,
that before.
Never seen that.
Right. So currently four bids, $361. Again, all these – currently it's the 14th and this auction ends on August 18th. So depending on when it comes out, there might be still time to bid on this. The next thing I want to point out is something I seriously want to bid on, and I can't believe how low it's at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
This thing, Apple Color Plotter. These are gorgeous, and this does not come up much, and right now it's at $267. Now, they say it's going to go for $2,000 plus. I also think it's going to go for $2,000 plus. But right now, everyone else is bidding on these other things and they're distracted. They're sitting on the Apple Color Plotter 420 or 410.
Mm-hmm.
I want one of these things. It is beautiful, beautiful. One of my favorite early Apple printers. And it's rare you find one of those things. So there's that. That's cool. There's, where is Steve? I'm just scrolling through. There's so many cool things.
Yeah.
Bill Gates. His Model 100 computer with a note on the back of it saying he doesn't need any more. This is a Microsoft's property. He's moving to the Model 200. Uh-huh. So you get the Model 100, whatever would still be left on it, maybe data-wise, I suspect nothing. Hmm. And on the back of it, a note signed from Bill Gates saying why he's not using it anymore. That's super cool. There's a bunch of note things. Then one of my favorite things of all, Steve Wozniak's Apple rainbow glasses. So click on this
wow.
one.
They're,
right?
They're
How
really,
cool are these?
And I think there are something, aren't there like six of them in the world or something like that? I mean, like there's some known small number of those.
Wow. That's
crazy. It says one of a limited issue of 30.
Okay.
How many would still survive?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably very few still around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you want to start up, say, I don't know, like a music festival.
Yeah.
First step would be to bid on these things. These things, unlike the printer stuff, are already at $5,500.
Yeah.
These are very popular item. But this whole auction is super cool. Got Ted Nelson books, like so many things here. Every time I turned around, I found something else cool in it. This is one of the most remarkable auctions I've seen. There's a Atari Video Music, mm-hmm. Sometimes called the Migraine Machine. So it's the C240, unopened in a box.
Unopened.
$1,281.
Wow.
Sealed. Yep. Sealed still. So many cool things in this auction.
That's
it's
crazy.
Remarkable. Yeah. I don't know where this kind of collection came from, but it's definitely worth taking a look. We'll have a link in the show notes, and Paul should buy all of these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an Tektronix 465 oscilloscope. Maybe you could play tennis for two on it. Bring everything full circle.
Excellent.
That is an amazing collection of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like every
crazy,
single
crazy,
thing.
Crazy, crazy.
The one thing about the Model 100 too, and Bill Gates, is I think if I'm not mistaken, that's sort of like the last that like he contributed actual code to the BASIC in the Model 100, so that it has there's a Bill Gates connection to that as well.
Very cool.
There's this little thing on the back dated to 12786, saying he doesn't need it anymore. It's MS property. Look at that penmanship. The penmanship of a guy who never had to write.
Yeah.
That is an engineer's handwriting right there.
Yep.
That is pretty funny.
Super impressive auction. One of the most interesting collections I've seen. Nice. I seriously want those rainbow glasses. I'm seriously not spending $5,000 or $6,000 on
Yeah. Those. Boy, if I had infinite money, though, I would definitely buy those.
Yep.
So it's interesting that the Apple One prototype appears to be mounted in some sort of frame, like I guess that's probably just for people to
and it's called the Apple Computer
later.
A.
When it looks like it's broken.
Yeah,
I don't understand
yeah.
what's happening there.
Yeah, it's missing part of it. So like it's
when they chipped
clearly
it out of the
working.
Stone, they did some damage. They imagined the legs were attached this way, and it was covered in feathers.
Yeah. It is interesting though. I mean, like it is like it says. Copyright symbol 76 on it. They didn't even bother to write the 19 part.
Okay, so someone found this and then they've built this display structure frame thing for it, I guess. Is that's what's happened here?
Yeah, I think so. I thought the story was that this was actually, this was a model that was carted around, like a board that was carted around to show people, like the bike shop or whatever.
It could be.
Presumably
definitely
pre-broken part.
Yeah.
Well, and that frame has lights in it, even, it looked like. So it's quite an elaborate frame that's been built for it for whatever purpose.
Yeah. Though I could imagine.
The board offered has been matched to a Polaroid photograph taken by Paul Terrell in 1976, showing this exact prototype in use. I guess they matched the wire wraps or whatever.
Yeah.
Makes you wonder why they didn't sell this at the height of Apple One mania. Like, I feel like now you're going to get half of what you would have.
Yeah, because back then, easily, they'd go for $1 million or something.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, ones with much less provenance than this were going for seven figures. So, yeah, it's just,
this is a pittance at $407,000. I got that on me now.
It's not even worth bidding on.
It's not worth my time. Don't know why I brought it up. So anyway, it's a remarkable auction. Everybody should go look at the stuff. And I want this pin. I want this the Apple Award, the Apple Cross.
The Apple Cross.
I guess whoever killed the most Microsoft employees gets awarded the Apple Cross. Or maybe if you're wounded in engineering, for what do you get awarded the Apple Cross?
Yeah.
Burn yourself with a soldering iron. Sorry, soldering iron. Sorry, yes, Michael.
Soldering iron. Right. And we're showing right now is the plotter that I want so desperately. Mm-hmm. It is such a beautiful print.
And it's beautiful. The problem with old plotters, though, is always the pens, right? You can't get the pens anymore.
Yeah. I hunted for a long time for one of those and do finally have one.
Do you have one? I love these. I never had one, so maybe that's why I covet it so much, because I never had one, but I love the look of this thing.
Yeah, I haven't connected it yet, but I want to connect it to the Apple III if I can, because it is possible to do that. I'm gesturing toward the Apple III. I seem to have a sunspot on my head, too.
Those listening at home, Paul is gesturing with his left hand.
I didn't realize that the Apple plotter has a cartridge with the pens in it that looks like it rotates. That's really neat. There was a picture of it there that you scrolled past.
Scroll back.
This thing. That's really cool.
So I think it just holds the pens. The pens are not... You can replace one pen at a time, not all four at once.
Okay, that's good. I was going to ask, because, for the viewers at home, it looks sort of like a hockey puck, and there's a little spinning hub in the middle.
For the Canadian viewers at home.
And it looks like the hub in the middle spins to select the pen, but, if you had to replace the whole thing at once, then, you have no hope of ever getting replacements, I guess. But it seems like it comes with three new old stock sets of pens, although I'm sure they're all dried out and useless by now.
Yeah. It's got the same colors as those color selectable pen ballpoints.
So maybe you just stick those in, snip them off.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a way to use a syringe to inject new ink into them or something. Because I know the Atari plotter people have somehow resurrected those, so there must be a way to get the pens working.
I'll show you one video with a syringe. Now everything's syringe.
Yeah,
just inject everything.
Excellent. That's it. Okay. Those are my options.
Okay, cool. All right, I have some. Let's see. Some of the ones that I have are over, but that's okay. I think they're interesting. they were always going to be over. Who am I kidding? How quick am I going to get this out? So the first one is Sirius Software 1982 spring lineup and press release sales sheets. This ended yesterday, I think, as we're recording, and it ended over $1,000, which was a lot more than what I was expecting. It started at 40. So, I mean, last week I had this, all up, and I was going to talk about it, and it was $40 at that point. But these are actually really cool. They're advertising. They're for stores, I guess. They're promotional things. So there's a retail price list and a dealer price list. And I guess, so if you're a dealer, you can get them cheaper. So that, I think, would have been actually quite interesting to see, although I think the auction only shows us what the retail prices were. So whoever bought this, I'm hoping that we'll see some sort of scans of them. But they also included, I don't know if you had this experience with record stores back in the 80s or whatever, but they would get these flats, I think that's what they would call them, which is basically the covers, the cardboard covers of the album, except they didn't contain anything. They were just a flat thing that the record stores would put in their windows or on their walls or whatever. And I would, sometimes go to the record stores and collect these, they would give them away.
I didn't know that was, I always thought they were just albums stuck up on the window in the wall. I was just assumed it was the real album.
Yeah, no, they distributed just the part the promotional
today
part.
Today I learned.
Yeah. But anyway, so these are the same kind of thing, but for these video games. I had no idea such things existed. But you know, on the front they have the cover art. On the back they have like a, you know, sales blurb. They're
fun, cool things to display.
Yeah, in really great shape. So I can sort of see why they went for so
that's
much.
That's still a lot of money. My goodness.
Yeah.
$1,000.
It is always amazing to see the box art for all these games that none of us ever paid for. Like, like Snakebite.
Snakebite had packaging? Who knew?
Yeah, Beer Run. Like all these games that we all had 28 totally legitimate backups of.
Yeah. Yeah, these were early ones. So like Beer Run, I think that was pretty much like the first game I had a copy of on a disc, you know. Sneakers may have sneakers. Snuck in a little sooner.
Sneakers. Yeah. Sneakers. My gosh, did I have copies of Sneakers?
Yeah, that's a good game too.
Totally great game.
Yeah,
I should have paid for that.
it's fun. It looks goofy. I mean, but it is fun to play. So
it's also interesting to see a world of video games before intellectual property, right? Like every single one of these games is just like a little made-up world with no characters, no branding, no line of toys or movies that goes with it. It's just, here's a weird thing about a guy running around collecting beer. Like it's, I don't know, there's an innocence to it that I love and that I miss. Like you can't buy any product now without getting sucked into this world of branding that goes with it. Mm. Everything is a property.
Who works at AAA Gaming, folks?
It was actually, they were getting a little close to that with this Grud character. You know, like they did have this
Well, I don't know about close, but they were swinging for the fences there. Let's say that.
Okay. It's not quite a character in the same way, though.
Yeah, but you can see the early attempts at each of these companies, like Sierra was doing this as well, to try and create a family of related products. And they were even overlapping, trying to, like, there was another game that was supposed to be in the same world as Lode Runner, like the incompetent evil corporation.
The
was supposed to be the same
Empire.
One as in this other game.
Yeah, the Bungling Empire. Yeah.
The Bungling Empire, yeah. But like
River Raid.
Yeah, but it never really clicked. Like, it didn't really work the way they maybe wanted it to, but, yeah.
The same seller has a couple of other things that are sort of like this. I wasn't actually originally planning on talking about these, but I might as well. They're, you know, sort of other promotional things as well. So
they must have been a dealer.
Yeah. So like a Cannonball Blitz thing. That I mean, that's got to be quite rare.
Wow.
I've never seen the promotional version of that. A Piccadilly catalog. I think these are the covers to at least Escape is like super unknown Sublogic game.
Yeah. I had Sublogic Pinball.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, this must be like someone who had a computer store back in the day and is cleaning out their attic or something. Yeah.
I'm super interested in, there's a brochure in this one, If High-Res Adventures Are Your Passion.
Uh-huh.
It opens up and it talks about Mystery House and Cranston Manor and stuff. And I have not ever seen this online systems brochure before. I hope this gets scanned.
Yeah.
I've never seen this.
Yeah, that is pretty, that has got to be quite rare.
And everything's just in flawless condition.
Yeah.
Like there isn't a single mark on any of this stuff, not a turned corner.
Because it's all fake.
Like, nothing's faded. Nothing's folded. Like really.
Suspicious.
Yeah. And I guess the third of the three has Datamos stuff in it, which is that this stuff is primarily, it might have been promotional, but it's really actually just the regular folders that the discs came in, for the most part.
It's still in amazing shape.
They are, yeah. And there are a couple of cool catalogs too. This one I had, I don't have it anymore, but I had it. The Funtastic one, and then there's another one that's sort of similar.
That's not a real word.
Yeah.
But I'm also reminded how impossible it was to know how fun a game is by looking at the packaging in these days, because there was no screenshots on the box because the technology for that didn't really exist. So you're just looking at like some artist's conception of what this game is, and there's just absolutely no way to know if it's going to be any fun or not.
Yeah,
it's not even what the game is. The artist conception of what the game feels like. Yeah. Feels kind of like this.
So yeah, did Swashbuckler really play like that picture?
Yeah, no. But it was a great game. It was a good one. But yeah, but some of these were terrible and you wouldn't know. And some of them were great and you wouldn't know from these boxes. Yeah.
The seller has a lot of things for sale that are in amazing shape. My goodness, I'm looking through other listings.
A lot of really early stuff too. Like these are early games.
I played a lot of Snack Attack, which was, and I still don't quite understand how it is that you have, like, you play a whale that is running around a maze with some sort of like propeller-like tail. I don't know, but it's creative, I guess. Okay, let's see. Next thing is not quite that impressive, but also sold, I think, already. But it is a Mac phone. And what it is a phone that you hang on the side of your Mac.
What?
Look at that. That's so cool looking.
It's interesting.
Very strange accessory. For Macintosh lovers only, it says.
Oh.
Is there an Apple logo embossed in the corner there? Is that what that is? No.
No, it looks like they've kind of faked it. Like it's their own logo, but done in that.
It's done in the Apple style, yeah.
So here's what your Mac phone does.
It's sort of cool looking. Yeah. Does it actually plug into the Mac and do stuff, or is it just a phone that hangs on your monitor?
I think it does have some ability to, quick dial feature. Well, of course.
So it does have some sort of interface card of some sort, presumably.
Yeah.
Oh, it wouldn't take cards. It must just plug in by
Like some sort of serial thing.
Oh, like a serial. Oh, okay. Kind of a neat thing.
Yeah. It's one of those things that they probably hoped would last more useful years than it did.
Yeah.
I mean, the models that you plugged it on, hung it on, didn't last very long, and the phones themselves didn't last very long.
But if it dials out digitally, it would work today. So this is a cool accessory, unlike most modems. Like, what do you do with a modem if you buy it for an old Mac Plus now?
Yeah.
This thing you could use and dial and use as a phone with the modern connection.
If you have a landline, this is still usable. And it looks like you can use it as the Mac can dial the phone, if I understood that text right on the box there. Yeah. It's neat.
I think it's very cool. It's $650 for starting bid, but nobody's bid yet.
Yeah, well, and I think it actually ended with nobody bidding.
Oh, did it? Oh.
Yeah, but maybe it'll get relisted. So
for even less.
Yeah. So I'm going for the interesting auction rather than the available auction.
And in original box too. So that's got to be crazy rare. But it seems
I've never seen this before.
It seems to be in that weird niche of crazy rare in great condition. But nobody cares about it.
Because
it came and went with zero bids. Like, for the rarity of it, it could have easily gone for many thousands of dollars, but it came and went at $650 with no bids. So.
Yeah, because we never promoted it before. Now people are going to watch it.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Now the big money comes in.
Yeah, but it's further evidence that rarity does not equal value. People also have to care about the thing.
Don't I know it. Only one of me.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. Wait, was that out loud?
Just saying the quiet part out loud again.
You sort of beat me to saying exactly that. okay, so this one, I just thought it was interesting. It's an Apple III, but what's interesting about it to me is all of the boxes.
Yeah, what's interesting about that?
It's it's got all a lot of the boxes. It has a little sticker on the space bar that says how many K it has. It has a little cardboard insert still in the disk drive.
The shipping thing for the disk drive, that's really cool, actually. We've seen a few 2Cs in original packaging, but we've never seen an Apple III like this.
Well, the boxes are beat up.
Yeah, have seen better days, but they exist, at least.
Some suspicious water damage there.
I was going to say, that seriously looks water damaged. That would be my fear.
Yeah. I would worry about
the inside of these things.
But they do show pictures of the machine powered up and working, which is nice. So I guess it's okay. But
and the foam would have given it at least a few inches there, even if it sat and accidentally got some water.
It does, I think, we can sort of see, I don't know if we can see the actual bottom. Damaged. Yeah, I guess we can here.
The case is aluminum, so it should be okay if it got a little wet.
Yeah, and even the stickers on the bottom don't seem to be water.
You take those off with a syringe.
That's true, yeah. The disk drive box is kind of interesting too, because it's you know, you can see on it the labels of all the things that they could have put in there. So it could have been a disk two. It could have been a disk two that came with the Bell and Howell. It could have been a disk three. This one was a disk three. You know, so it's an interesting box just by itself.
And its serial number is 38628, which to me says they didn't start at one.
Yeah, for the disk threes, probably conceivably not. Though, I mean, the disk two serial numbers get so high. I mean, very high.
That was
there were many, many of them.
Everyone loved it.
I've never actually seen a disk three, like the external Apple III drive. So that's kind of neat. It looks like the Apple IIc external drive, except taller.
Oh yeah, it does. You're right. It's got that same kind of shape and little
that kind of roundy styling. Yeah.
Well spotted. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, the drive door comes out in a in a sort of a regular disk two way rather than a whatever the sort of pop in and pop up way that the 2C does.
But. Yeah. I'm sure it's the same Shugart mechanism as in the disk twos. They just put it in a different plastic. But it's neat because it matches.
Yeah. Well, and like the profile. You know, if you can imagine the profile drive for the Apple, that, people see them on the Lisa or whatever, and you can have them with a disk two or your Apple II, but it's obviously designed to sit on an Apple III. I mean, like that, it is in the Apple III design.
Yeah.
It looks ridiculous on top of a Lisa.
Yeah. Well, I had the Monitor III with my Apple II Plus.
Right.
That was what the dealer sold us because it was like the best monochrome monitor you could buy at the time when we were buying R2 Plus. So it was decades before I understood that was actually the Apple III monitor that I had and still have. It's in my dad's basement. But yeah, it's a nice monitor if you like the green screens.
It's very sort of like, I don't know what you have, like high persistence, long persistence. It is persistent.
Yeah, it's slow, I think is the word you're looking for.
Okay.
The thing that I remember about it most is that the screen is difficult to clean because it has this kind of like relief mesh, like molded right into the glass. I assume it's some sort of anti-glare thing, but it's very difficult to clean because it's like trying to clean a waffle iron. Like it's a very small scale waffle iron.
Yeah. And the problem with those is that if they tear, then you kind of want to just take the whole thing off because you don't want this like one bright spot.
Yeah.
But it is, I think, anti-glare. You could get them sort of separately for the Lisa. So the Lisa monitors, you could get a thing that you put in between the sort of the case and the monitor that would keep it from reflecting you back at it or at yourself.
I guess, okay. I don't think I realized that was an insert. I thought that was just how the tube was on those monitors. That's interesting.
On these, I don't think they're not easily replaceable. Usually what I see people do is cut them out, leaving the frayed edge.
Okay. But, yeah, I've never taken the monitor apart, so I just assumed that was the front of the tube that had that weird glass molded texture on it.
Yeah.
TIL.
It's pretty effective, I think, as glare, except as glare guard, except that it just doesn't. You have to be careful with it.
Yeah, it is a nice looking monitor, but it was impossible to clean because you try to wipe it and it's just like, wiping Velcro. It's very strange.
What else? Oh, this is I'm sure this came up once before, but this is the TRS-80 interface to the plug and power system from Radio Shack, which is X10.
Like an X10 system.
Yeah. Okay.
Good old X10.
I guess I don't have it set up here, but for a very long time I had it set up in like all of the places I lived where I had a little remote that I could turn on the plant light or whatever. Very convenient.
Paul had to grow up is what I'm taking from that.
No, actually we lived in a sort of like a, it was sort of like a negative 0.5 floor apartment. So it was the only way that we could keep our plant alive was essentially because our windows looked onto our courtyard that itself got almost no light. So
X10 was a beautiful dream, but it never quite worked never quite lived up to the promise. It was too flaky. Like I have had it in various apartments and houses over the years, and because you can still buy the stuff, you can still buy X10 lamps and stuff, but it really depends on there being no noise on your power line, and also like depending if your lamp and your switch are. If the two circuits are on different phases of your power, for anyone who doesn't know,
which side of the panel is on.
In North America, our household power is split across two phases. So half your outlets and half your lights are on one phase and half are on the other. And if they're split, then the X10 signal has to go all the way out to the street to the nearest transformer and back into your house again, which will work, except that it's effectively going through your neighbor's houses at the same time. And so if your neighbor changes something, like they plug in a new heater or something and put a bunch of noise onto the line, suddenly your automatic lamp stops working. And there was, so your lamp would work for a year and then one day stop and it would never work again. And you'd have no idea why. And it was like Bluetooth
Bluetooth before Bluetooth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was just maddening.
But meanwhile, whenever you hit the button, like your neighbor's lights go on and off.
Yeah. But when it worked, it was nice.
Yeah. It did seem fairly magical.
So. Well, it's such a good idea. I think we all keep buying it for 50 years because it's such a good idea, but it just doesn't quite work.
Yeah. Anyway, so if you have a TRS-80 and a house that this will work in, like you live out in the country or whatever and have no neighbors, $70, buy it now. That's not too bad for something that maybe you'll never be able to use, but anyway, yeah. Let's see. Do I have anything else? Oh, yeah, this is potentially interesting. This is an EasyKey Timex Sinclair keyboard. And it is pretty hilarious. So I guess these pictures themselves don't show the hilarity of it. But, so it's a big blue chiclet keyboard. And what it actually is, let's see, there's another auction, I think it ended, but that actually sort of shows how this works. So this is a thing that was marketed for the Timex Sinclair, and, it gives you like a mildly more reasonable keyboard than the actual physical thing did. The physical thing goes inside this giant keyboard.
Yeah, can I go say, the Sinclair's the ZX80 or whatever, we're tiny.
Yeah.
This thing is five times the size of the Sinclair 1000.
The keyboard is this like big, sort of like triangular wedge or whatever, and in the corner of it, is in amongst almost entirely empty space is like a little Timex Sinclair 1000 with like ribbon cables coming out of it to feed the keyboard on top.
Wow, that is interesting.
So
it looks a bit like the Sol 100 or whatever, that computer with the blue signs.
Yeah, it does. It really does sort of feel like you're pretending you have a better computer than you do.
Yeah.
Though I guess it's true that you could probably fit, like the memory module in the back and stuff like that, and still close the case. So.
But it's such a tall case. Like it's so thick. Like one of the very very few things about the early Sinclairs that's better than a lot of its contemporaries is it didn't make you type like you're above your forehead. Like you stick an Apple IIe on a proper desk height thing and it's 37 inches tall. Like it's way too tall to type.
Yeah.
And so this says, okay, the only thing we had going for us, at least it was desk height. Oh no, my friend, we're cranking it up 5.5 inches to
Well, yeah. At least it was small. Like, they were crappy computers, but, you can stick it on the corner of your desk, and it's kind of a fun thing. At least it's small. Yeah. Well, nope, not anymore.
Now it's 7 pounds of metal.
Now it's enormous and terrible.
Yeah. And quite off-center.
Yeah, why did... it didn't need to be. There's no reason for it to be that big. They must have gotten a lot of these cases somehow. Like, this is a case from something else.
Yeah.
There's a lot of holes in the side. Were there supposed to be other things that went in there, peripherals or whatever, and all the cables would come out or come in?
Well, I think there are. I think the Timex Sinclair 1000 has a couple of things, but it does seem like that's more holes than we need. So one of them is video, but I think there was a like audio something.
Maybe it was intended to work with other computers as well. Like maybe it would also work with the ZX80 and, you know, some other crappy small computers that could fit. Like that might also be why it was so big, was maybe you could also put a VIC-20 in here or something if you wanted a different keyboard or whatever. I don't know. I'm trying to defend this thing. I don't know why, but I can't explain any other way.
Yeah.
There also appears to be nothing attaching it to the, like it's just sitting in there. So does it not slide around in there?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I had an ad. Did I? Yeah. Here's an ad for it.
Join the click.
Yeah.
Okay, so it does. It's a bunch of variants. So maybe those other holes are needed for all the different variants of the.
Well, and it does say like ear mic something.
Power.
So I think this was specifically for this.
But they list in the previous image, they listed like four different model numbers, so probably they all had the ports in slightly different places or something.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, see ZX81, TS1000, TS1500. I bet all those different machines have slightly different port placements.
That's possible, yeah.
And there's clearly different versions of this, because the one that you've got in the original auction has a different keyboard than the one in the ad. Like, it's bigger. The one in the ad is smaller keyboard, shuns it off to the left, and in your original auction, it's a keyboard that's the whole width of the thing.
Yes, you're right. Okay, yes.
Yeah, so this was so popular, they came out with versions.
I didn't realize that I had...
The keyboard is the same.
Or is it the same? The
case
keyboard,
is smaller.
The box is bigger.
The box yeah, the different sized boxes, yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. So, okay, so... Because I was going to say, I think this... I would suspect that maybe this was like a point of sale system that, you know, like the boxes were for something else and that might have been it.
I think that they developed a product because he bought a lot of these metal boxes and it's like, how can I make this into something?
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
Life gives you metal boxes.
Yeah. You make the Easy Key 60.
Yeah.
That is an odd thing.
Anyway, yeah, I was pleased to have come across it, I guess, basically. But
how many are you going to buy?
I think I have already bought as many as I'm going to, and that is none. But
well worded.
Yeah. I'm kind of interested in the ZX80 and the Tamek Sinclair 1000 a little bit. Like, I would like to use them. I would like to have used them a little bit.
The amount you should use them.
Yep.
Also cleverly worded.
Okay. Anyway, that's that is it for my auctions this time. So, any others?
So I have sort of a virtual auction, if you will. Uh-huh. So, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I recently moved, and you know, when you move, you find all sorts of things that you don't even really realize that you had, and sometimes you own a thing for so many years that it just becomes background noise and your brain just tunes it out. But I just realized in this unpacking how cool this thing that I have actually is. So I'm going to show it on my camera here for the benefit of our local stream
folks.
It's going
to be a cat. I know it.
So this is an original box from a Commodore 1571 disk drive. And I mean, I've been using it to hold my stationery, as you can see. And this has been my stationery box for like 15 years. I have no idea where I got this thing. I have never owned a Commodore 1571. I have no idea where this box came from. But the extra cool part of it is, let me see if I can get this on camera here. It has the original price
tag on it.
And if you look closely, our Canadian viewers will recognize the Canadian Tire logo in the center of that price tag.
Absolutely.
So this is an original price tag from Canadian Tire in maybe 1985 or 6, somewhere in there. I don't know when a 1571 would have been contemporary, but yeah, $500 Canadian in mid-1980s. So that would have been, I don't know, $1,000 or something today. So this would have been an extremely expensive item. But it's obviously not in the best of shape because I've been using it for Commodore 1571 storage purposes, but it's a kind of a neat artifact, and I just suddenly realized that I have this thing. So,
never had the drive.
That's the weird thing.
Yeah, I have no memory of where this box came from. I don't know.
And if it was bought with Canadian Tire money.
Yeah, so I actually do have a Commodore 64 in my dad's basement that was given to me by a friend who didn't want it anymore. But he had a 1541. It was just your standard Commodore bread box with the 1541. So I've no idea. I'm sure I do not own a 1571 disk drive, so I have no idea where this box came from. But yeah, it's kind of a neat thing. I don't know. But I just love that it had the original Canadian Tire price tag on it. That just slays me.
That's excellent.
You ever get rid of the box, you can save that price tag. You know how you can remove it?
Yeah.
With a syringe.
That's right.
Full circle. Yeah. And I guess non-Canadians wouldn't know this, but Canadian Tire was one of the places that sold Commodore stuff. Because, you know, Commodore stuff was famously sold in very mainstreamy kinds of places like Kmart and so on, which is part of why it was so successful. You didn't have to go to a fancy computer store to get it. And yeah, Canadian. And I actually do remember back in the day going to Canadian Tire with my Commodore friend to buy, like, he needed a new power supply. We all remember how incredibly reliable those Commodore 64 power bricks were. And so I remember going to Canadian Tire with him to buy one of those. So yeah, it's neat. But don't know where I got this, but it was a cool kind of rediscovery in all of my stuff when I moved.
And I think that is like a desirable drive too, right? I mean, like, that's like, people now want that drive. They don't want your stationery. They want what used to be in it.
Yeah. I should list this on eBay with no explanation, and someone will be super disappointed when they open it. They find out. They find a bunch of old greeting cards and ribbon.
All right. I think we've made it through our eBay and other auctions. So now I guess we can go to closing discussions. Carrington, you have the first thing written down here.
I just wanted to mention a couple of books I read last week that I really, really liked. Yes. The first was, which I mentioned before, Where Wizards Stay Up Late, which is about ARPA and the ARPANET and early development of the internet. It was really, really good. And another one I read called Proving Ground, which was about women programmers for the ENIAC and how getting kind of like thrown in, here's the ENIAC, here are some scans of its chips or circuitry, we need you to program it, go. It's like that was the training. And just a fascinating group of brilliant people just thrown in, like hired by the army and say, okay, program this, and just doing that, like coming together and learning to program it, and just amazing book. Really, really, really enjoyed it. So highly recommend both those books. They were super fun.
Cool.
That was it. Both. Because when I bring up computer books, it's mostly to hate on them. Say, this was terrible. I did this thing. These were two I actually quite enjoyed.
Interesting. So it's been a long time since we've recorded, you know. So like Kansas Fest happened since the last time we recorded, and I made that arcade game I claimed I was going to be making, which is kind of cool.
Well, excellent.
That's exciting. On the Apple III?
On the Apple III, yeah. Let me see if I can even
feel like we're being Hackfest judges.
Well, look at that.
Yeah, so that's pretty awesome. It's pretty cool. Game is basically like you're in a big,
what the heck, man, that's very good.
Yeah, the scrolling is so good.
Yeah, well then that was good the job. What I was wow. That was what I was attempting.
Why is the scrolling so good? What the heck, dude.
Yeah. The Apple III has scroll registers.
Like, yeah,
such an unsung hero in terms of graphics hardware, this thing.
Yeah, it's set up in such a way that like the middle region is a text mode, and then like there's high res scrolling around it. So like one of the cool things about it is that it's switching video modes like as the screen paints, you know. So,
oh, cool.
But anyway, it was a lot of fun to do, and it was an interesting challenge because nothing is documented. So,
right.
Did you document it?
Sort of. I mean, you know, you can go to GitHub and see how I did the things that I did do.
How did you? Because it's not like the Apple II or the Commodore 64 where everybody knows everything about them now, so you can just Google stuff and find how to do all these tricks. So how did you manage that?
There is a document. I forget what it's called, but it's not actually called the technical reference manual. It's like the repair manual or something like that, you know, for level 2 technicians. But it has, you know, the information on like, you know, what the soft switches do what and that kind of thing. So it's sort of deducible.
The repair technician would come to your house and be like, oh, you see your scroll registers are stuck, so we're going to need to order that.
But
it was a couple weeks.
An interesting kind of exercise because, you know, some of the stuff like I made heavy use of horizontal blanking interrupts, but I have never found that written down anywhere that they have them. Somebody disassembled like a video game that Andy Hertzfeld made that used them.
Wow.
So like he used his crazy insider knowledge.
Wow. So there's a huge documentation gap there then, because yeah, this machine is capable of a lot, but we may never know.
Right.
It's amazing you put out a machine and hope everyone's going to make software for it, but what you do is hide the way to make software for
That's
it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's some thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think they probably weren't aiming for the you know, the gaming sector anyway, but it does, it has some stuff in it, you know, that allows for that, you know. So it has these like horizontal and vertical blanking interrupts and reprogrammable character sets and, you know, all this other stuff. And
Now there's a game for the Apple III.
Yeah, I think I might have like the third one or something. But anyway, that was fun though. It was an interesting exercise getting back into just 6502 programming and, you know, trying to figure out how I can cram as much as, you know, action as I can and do as little smallest cycle count as I can, because
impressive.
Don't have very long before that starts repainting again.
So. Is there a video about this? But your project from Kansas Fest, or?
There is, yeah. Yeah, in fact, what I did was I you know, put myself on camera, and I hit record, and I talked, and it was like 90 minutes long. I'm like, all right, well, I have a 45-minute spot, so, but I do.
Double speed.
Yeah, I thought about that, but in fact, what I did is I just, like, there's a link to the director's cut of my talk, but
Is there a DVD commentary as well with that? Or?
I'm hoping.
Oh, I'll
so.
Make yeah. a commentary track.
So here's how. Yeah, and I've of course learned quite a bit since then about like ways that I didn't do it quite right, you know. So, but anyway, it's fun, and I'm not quite done. You know, the game doesn't have a way to win or lose it. But
yeah, but you shouldn't. Yeah. I mean, that's an easy thing to say, but in all seriousness, mm-hmm. it's very easy to chastise yourself. Like mm-hmm. I do every time you make a thing, you think I could have done better. These are things I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I'm embarrassed by my code. Whatever. What, you got a game out for the Apple III, dude. Yeah. I don't care if you could now make a better game. Yeah. Well, yeah, you already made one. Like that's a crazy achievement. Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, yeah, it was fun.
Awesome.
Yeah. You know how many people haven't done it? Everybody else.
Did you develop it like on MAME's emulator or on real hardware or both, or?
I basically developed it on MAME and then tested it, you know, on using you know, like a SD card, you know, on the actual Apple III. But
yeah.
Actually, so that was an interesting trick too, because MAME, there's at least as of recording, MAME is too forgiving, you know. MAME runs too fast. The actual hardware runs too slow.
Yeah, I was going to ask what differences you found with the emulators, because there's always little differences, especially if you're dealing with interrupts and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, the funny thing about this one is that, and of course, you know, you realize that I've already revealed that if I start talking about this, I might stop talking 90 minutes later. But but the funny thing about this is that the Apple III, when it's drawing, goes Apple II speeds, you know, it's like 1 megahertz as it's drawing. And then when it does vertical refresh, it goes 2 megahertz. And what MAME does is just goes 2 megahertz all the time. So okay. It's very easy for me to think that I have achieved something that I have actually not.
Yeah, the 2GS emulators are like that too. They give you a little more vertical blank time than the real hardware does. So you think you're doing great, and then you run out of real hardware and it's all garbage. Like, oh, great.
Yeah.
And especially if you're doing like crazy interrupt tricks and stuff, that's mm-hmm. playing with fire and emulators. Because like I ran into that with writing a mouse driver for the 2C Plus. Like, mm-hmm. You find all the holes in all the emulators because none of them do certain things correct on this obscure hardware. Because like nobody's ever sat down and compared the emulator to this obscure hardware because right. nobody cares about this obscure hardware. So yeah, you find all those little problems.
But I think the the emulator developers like that, you know, ultimately, because like, yeah. you know, now somebody has tested it and now yeah. they know what the answer is.
And did you open issues with MAME's emulator about all the stuff you found?
I will. I haven't. I will.
That'll help the next person a lot. So that's awesome.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Anyway, so that's my recent stuff. Quinn, do you have any sort of closing thoughts?
Well, that's a tough act to follow. I did Sorry. Not write the third game ever for an obscure platform that has secretly awesome graphics hardware. But I did mostly complete my big move from one country to another. So my Apple IIc Plus.
Welcome home.
Yes, thank you. My 2C Plus appears to have survived the journey. I have not powered it up yet, but the box that it was in good condition, and the machine is, I checked it for cracks and there aren't any, so it seems to be okay. So I'll be powering that up, and I've got a bigger office space here than I had in my last place, so I'll be able to set it up. I'd like to just set it up permanently. I want to have a little retro computing area over here to my left, and I want to go and get my 2GS from my dad's basement, and even the Commodore 64, and maybe set that up as well, and just start playing with stuff. So excited to have some stuff set up, because I like the real hardware, but it's, if it's not set up, then you won't use it, because it's such a hassle to go get it out of the bins and plug everything in and remember how to use the SD card reader or whatever. So if I can just have it set up, I think it'll be fun, because I can just sit down and play with it for 5 minutes here and there. So I'm looking forward to that. So that's the plan, is maybe by next time we record, I'll have some real retro hardware in here again.
Cool. You can be like a retro MacCast, you know, like behind you, you can see the vast array of machinery.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I won't be going I won't be going full Blake or anything, but there will be some hardware behind me here at some point. Although with this camera angle, you won't be able to see it, but I'll have to take my word for it. It'll be back there. Actually, I guess I could
tell from the echoes. Hey, yeah. You've added something.
Yeah, it'll be sort of right there, kind of.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Anyway, that was great radio, but anyway, I was gesturing at the corner of a screen there for the listeners at home.
Yeah. All right. I guess we made it. Not bad. Congratulations to all involved. So I guess that is it for the show. You can find the notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at @rcrpodcast. And if you watch the live stream, you can watch all of the other hosts dance. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. Send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Yeah. I was wondering if people were going to say that. Yeah, there was a typo in our... I'm embarrassed that I did not participate in the retro computing.
I was going to do it, and I thought, no one's going to get the joke, because nobody at home is going to be seeing the chat in the stream.
I don't care if people get my jokes. No one gets my jokes. It's all good.
Anyway, yes. Excellent.